The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
I present you today a paper which is a kind of spin-off of my forthcoming book at Verso, which is Fictitious Capital. And here I'm focusing more on one aspect of the issue, which is the relaxation between the profit investment nexus in an economy. And I will try to propose a kind of revisitation, a transformation of the monopolization hypothesis. So here we have this stylus fact that we can discuss because there are many ways to discuss that, but that's the idea that there is a relaxation between profit of the relation between profit and investment. So basically what that says is that right now there is less reinvested profit than before. So as you can see, there is a country that's not straightforward. For example, in the US, you have a decline here in the 80s, but a recuperation at the late 90s, but right now, a strong, significant decline. For the other countries, the UK, Germany, Japan, it's okay, but in France, you have a different trend. At the end of the period, you have an increase in terms of reinvested earnings, which in fact is related to the monetary union, basically. But that's other discussion that we could have. But okay, we can discuss that. But at least I think there is a kind of agreement that in a period of recuperation of profits, there has been a relaxation of the relation between profit and investment. This question is not is discussed in the heterodox literature. Glynn paper of 1997 was very important from this point of view. Basically, this paper said that in the post-war period, there was a straightforward link between profit and investment. And after the 70s, there has been a change in these relations. Many other heterodox writers have made some assessment about that, and we will discuss some of them. But that's also an issue which is discussed in the mainstream, but for the more recent period, and in different ways. But for example, you have especially in finance and corporate governance literature, some authors are pointing good on a decline of the investment cash flow sensibility. They also observe a kind of not very strange link between investment and Tobin's Q. So valuation is not consistent with the level of investment. Profit are not reinvested. And most of them, it's more in the 2000, since the early 2000s. So that's a period which is a little bit different. So that's the context. So, and indeed, this stylus fact is puzzling. To say it very basically, when you have profits, or if you're a Marxist, you think that profit should be reinvested. If you have opportunity to make more profit afterwards, if you are making profit, you should reinvest more. And if you are a post-Keynesian, you're like Kaleski, if you, in order to have profit, you need some investment. So having profit without investment is not very consistent. So there is a kind of puzzle. So let's move through very rapidly through this paper. So I just want to make a brief review of the literature and trying to clarify the discussion and not necessarily resolve it, and making an attempt to push this monopolization hypothesis, but through a critical appropriation of this hypothesis. I have some stylus facts, but there is no time to present them, so if there is time in the discussion, I will just present some, but I think I have no time. So the three stories are this one: the revenge of the rentiers, the financial turn of accumulation, and globalization. And so my first story, the revenge of the rentier. It's very simple. It's the idea that there is financial outflow which are taken from non-financial firms and that prevent firms to reinvest their profits. That's the idea, for example, addressed by Unilever and Levy. And they say very clearly at some point that there is there could have been some gains in terms of neoliberalism, as there has been a recuperation of profits, but because of this financial predation, in one sense, there is not enough retained earnings, and without retained earnings, there is no investment. So that's the kind of first story. Second story, in the same story, a variation, but which is interesting, that's the idea of financial norm of Boyer. And this idea is interesting because it makes a connection between the financial coup of 1979, with the raise of the profit rates and the new financial norms in terms of shareholder value. Basically, the idea is that when you have very high interest rate, you have in the meantime higher requirement by shareholders in terms of returns on their shares. So I think this financial norm is interesting. And finally, you have Lazonic argument, which is more focused on the corporate governance and share value, shareholder value theory. And basically, what says Lazonic is the same as Dumesnil et Levy, but the core is not financial hegemony following the 1979 coup. But what is central is the shareholder value and the idea that with buybacks, there is a kind of short-term orientation of shareholders. So there are. This is a very sketchy summary of the argument, but I think that it helped to understand what connections there are in these various stories. First, you had 1979 coup, in the meantime the 70s financial liberalization began and so on. So you have rising opportunity of financial profit, rising interest rate, there is a kind of hurdle rate, shareholders want to have higher returns, so higher distributed profit, and because of rising interest rate in the early 80s and higher distributed profit, you don't have enough retain earnings to invest. That's basically the story. I think that there is one problem in that story. So for the first part about raising interest rates and so on, that makes sense. But for the part especially as the argument is pushed by Lazonic, there is a problem, is that if you're a capitalist, you are happy to have dividends or to have higher higher prices on your shares. And what is very striking in the US is that you have more, you have a lot of buybacks in order to support share prices. But if you have opportunity to invest, that's also a way to increase share prices. If an enterprise is investing, shares as a profit, future profit are anticipated, share will be higher. So that's not very straightforward in Lazonic argument, why investment could not be made. So I think there is another problem. Why firms are not reinvesting, and that will be developed further. So the second story, I will go very rapidly here. That's basically, there is Swizy would say that financialization it's of the accumulation process is because there is no good options to invest. You have the argument by Krippner, which has been very successful, very discussed in socioeconomic circles. So there is a new pattern of accumulation in which profit accrue primarily through financial channels rather than through trade and commodity production. And there is also a post-Keynesian version of this argument saying that there is a change in managers' preferences which don't want to commit themselves too much in terms of a fixed investment, and they prefer to have short-term returns on financial markets which are better aligned with their career and what shareholders are asking. So this is also interesting, so that's basically this story. You have higher financial profits and slower accumulation because you accumulate through financial channels. There are various problems with this story. One problem in particular is at some point where are financial profits coming from? So there is this kind of dialectic between fictitious capital, financial income and real accumulation, which is a complex story which I will not discuss here. But there is something interesting in this story. As far as you can find that there is higher financial income from financial corporation, and you can see that, it contradicts the first story. Because if you have more financial incomes, you have some earnings, you have some cash available, so you are able to invest. So there is not this squeeze of cash by finance toward non-financial corporation. So in the first story, to make it very simple, the non-financial firms are the victim, and in the second story, they are not the victim. They are taking advantage of financialization. So that's interesting. That's open the discussion, I think. Third story, it's globalization. And it's also a response to the second story, because there are some statistical issues with financial income of non-financial corporation, and a lot of time, this income, in fact, are income from abroad. And income from abroad are not necessarily financial income. They could be dividends from subsidiaries, especially. And so there is a lot of discussion on that kind of difficult point, but that's interesting. Because basically, what says the globalization story? It says that, okay, with trade can prop up accumulation. If you have lower input prices, you have more profits, and that more profits, that's opportunity to make an investment. Okay, so I go very rapidly. So basically, yes, that's it. You have more opportunity to make profit globally, and so you make profit by repurchasing dividends, or you are making profits through cheaper inputs. Okay, that's the third story. So you are basically not investing domestically because your profits are coming from abroad. Here is a monopolization hypothesis. So I will go very rapidly, but you know the argument of Sweezy and the Monthly Review School and so on. So there is competition, but at some point the process of competition eliminates the less efficient firms, and you get centralization. And because of centralization, you have a kind of agreement between oligopolistic firms, where price rigidity protects profit margins, and overcapacity is lower incentive to invest. So you don't have incentive to invest. In the meantime, you are able to protect your profit. And what's interesting in this story, what makes it seducing, is that it's allowed to reconcile part of the previous story. Why? Because if you have monopolization, you don't need to have retained earnings. You can distribute your earnings because you are not compelled to invest. You don't have really opportunity of investment because there is overcapacities, and you have kind of market power which allow you to profit from globalization. So that's nice, you know, that sounds good. But the life is not always nice, and there is a strong limitation on the argument. So Warren in particular has made a very compelling argument against this monopolization story, explaining that there is no such a thing as perfect competition, from which monopoly capitalism will depart, and that there is always differentiation in terms of profit rate and so on. So that's one problem. The other problem, which is recognized among the post-Keynesian version of the argument, is that you can have this argument at the industry level, but it's not very compelling when you move at the inter-industry level, because then you have a new dynamic of competition which pay between industries. You also have a period of problem of periodization, because in the 80s you have had more and more competition, and there is a lot of works on that, which empirical work on that from regulationist tradition, Brenner and Mediagrant and so on. So basically my point will be that it's monopolization hypothesis, not monopoly capitalism. It's not a stage, it's the moment. And we have to understand what is the moment, what could be the moment. Because always, yeah, I don't. So, 3 minutes. I'm almost there, but that's a bit complicated. So I think that what is interesting to look at is the vertical dimension of monopolization. And there has been this literature of global value chains making very important argument. One argument has been made by Guido Starosta. I don't know if he's here, but he's in the conference. It's very convincing, and he explained how you can have a sustainable hierarchy of capitals within vertical, within global value chains. But what he's not explaining, he's explaining how small capitals can survive, but he's not explaining why unannounced capital are able to preserve their privileged situation. You have Bella Fiore, which coins this very good formulation, centralization without concentration. I think he has got the point. You have technical, financial, and productive common, increasingly centralized, but in the meantime, you have fragmentation of production. But he's not explaining really that. He coined the term, but I think he has not good explanation. You have something in Aglietta, 1979, would say something, don't bother with legal forms of capitals. That's not the true reality of capitalism. Capital's power are going beyond the limits of the firms. And you have to look at that. And if you look at that, you understand that things, you have some small capitals, in fact, who are not autonomous capitals. They are dependent from technico-economic norms, which are made away from them. So my central point would be the following one. The ability to appropriate and surplus value from other capitals. So this idea that you have a hierarchy of capitals is linked to an ability to shape labor process beyond the frontier of the firms. And my last argument would be, why do you have this ability to shape the labor process beyond the frontier of the firms? What explains that? What explains that, I think, is the monopolization of the intellectual forces of production. And here you have this argument, very interesting, made by Duncan Foley in his Gordon lecture in 2013 about intellectual appropriation of values through intellectual rents. You have an argument made by Pagano about intellectual enclosures, intellectual property rights, which impact is much larger than traditional monopoly because it's not limited physically, it's constrained to the knowledge which is monopolized. You have the digital network effects, which are very important, not only what we know in information industries, but also something in all industries with a more and more important role of information system, which allow firm to accumulate data, and accumulating data, accumulating the ability to innovate and so on. And finally, and that explains what is the consequence of that. If you have such a monopolization of intellectual forces of production, your position is protected, but in the meantime, you are expanding your control of beyond the firm of the boundaries. And because of that, you have on the one hand disincentive for lead firms, so big capitals to invest, because their position is protected, but in the meantime, it doesn't give the small capitals the possibility to invest because they are preventing to using a lot of intellectual tools. So my conclusion, it's time to conclude. My conclusion will be that. So centralization without concentration, it's really a puzzle which helps to understand probably this profit relaxation of profits and investment relations. Is it an unprecedented phenomenon? So I'm not sure, but it's worth discussing that. I think that it is based on a dissociation between control over labor process and surplus value appropriation. And it's allowed by monopolization of intellectual forces of production. That's a configuration of property relation which is adverse to accumulation. Surplus value is independent from investment for enhanced capital, so they are not incentivized to invest. In the meantime, small capitals have not the resources and opportunity to invest, which fuels stagnations on the supply and demand side and favors exuberant financial sphere. I just want to add this last argument, that there is a political relevance for this monopolization hypothesis. It allows to discuss, to give some kind of explanation of the socio-political deterioration of the position of labor in terms of unemployment, segmentation, stratification and segmentation of the labor force, and so on, but also the reactionary character of contemporary capitalism. Because on the one hand, it helps to show that financial income derived from shares of firms monopolizing knowledge are just parasitism, but also that helps to explain how small capitals keep retarded in this global value chains where they have lower profits, so there is no competition from big capitals, and in the meantime they don't have the resources to modernize. Mm-hmm. So that helps to stress the reactionary character of that, and also that point to the socialization of intellectual forces of production. So confronting globalization without activating nationalistic effect, and also connecting socialist imaginaries with advanced features of capitalism. Well, thank you.
Hi. So when I saw some of the other themes on the panel, I completely revised my talk in the last 3 days. So I'm going to be stumbling through a few things, but hopefully this will be marginally coherent. So I guess just to sort of preface in a very general way, I've been haunted in some way by how do we actually locate the role of labor values and value theory within actually moving towards an attempt to explain the actual dynamics of profitability and accumulation. And I guess that to sort of jump ahead in some way, I've always been very hesitant, and I think you can actually find this in some ways in Marx, his own work, and I think you find it in different ways in a lot of the literature that's developed, that there's sort of this quantum of value, like production takes place and there's sort of this stuff, abstract labor, and it's like been produced in production, and then it kind of comes out of the productive sphere and it's redistributed in the sphere of circulation and through, you know, various things, the equalization of the rate of profit and the whole debate about the transformation of values into prices, that somehow it's regulative or determining. And I've always had some real problems with that. It's always seemed that there is a kind of a theoretical, or that explanation can very easily lend itself to a kind of a theoretical reification. That, you know, that there is, and that's sort of been, when I very first came across Capital, I was fascinated by it, but there's always been these questions. And so kind of a recurrent thing that I've thought about over the years is how do we actually understand the nature of money and its relationship to abstract labor and to value. So in some ways, what I'm going to talk about is far more abstract, but or sort of methodological in some ways. But I think that the link is that it seems to me that if we want to talk about the decline in the rate of investment, decline in the rate of accumulation, which I think pretty much I think all the data depend, you know, however we measure it, it sort of points that's been a phenomenon. And then there's a lot of different explanations, but I think in some ways the easiest Marxist explanation would be to say the rate of profit has fallen. And if the rate of profit has fallen, obviously that undermines investment incentives, and so it would actually be the fall in the rate of profit that would give rise to a decline in the rate of investment. Now, this is a whole nother can of worms, but then there's not any consensus about how do you actually measure the rate of profit. What are we talking about? I mean, the rate of profit, it's not like there's just a rate of profit. Oh, there it is, we can go out and measure it. Even if you go look at the data, there are different ways of calculating it. There's historic cost rates of profit, there's what's called current cost rates of profit. And I think all of those measures, if you actually look at them, is the historic cost, meaning the book value of firms' assets, is that the best measure of the rate of profit? Well, in some ways, yes, but then there are a lot of questions about, you know, when you have inflation and when you have technological change and those types of things. The published work I've done on this used what's typically called the current cost, or replacement rate of profit. I actually have come to believe that I don't think that's a valid measure of the rate of profit, but I don't know what else we use. So, you know, the point being is that I'm not going to get into the empirical weeds, but I think that what we can say in a general sense is that all the measures of the rate of profit seem to show that it was very high sometime in the late 30s and certainly coming out of World War II, and that it has fallen, so it declines, and then there's some question of what happens around 1980. And depending on how you measure the rate of profit, it either goes back up. So in the work, the article I published in Historical Materialism, it actually goes back up, but not as high as it once was. And that's what happens with what's called the current cost rate of profit. Other measures show that it tends to flatline. And so the bracketing all that, the point that I want to make, or at least try and make a little bit, is to what happened to the actual, is that it? Yeah, how did we get it? Oh, right here. Okay. So where am I on time? Probably 10 minutes. Okay. So a lot of the like I said, what I've been interested in is trying to understand how the link between money and labor values is actually produced. And I'm not going to talk about this in great detail, but the basic do you know how to do I do that?
That's it.
Okay. Yeah. This kind of ugly diagram. A lot of what I've been looking at is how the money wage is actually, I would argue that it's the new quasi-commodity anchor. So in it, what we want to understand is, in the absence of a commodity money, does money, to serve as a measure of value, does it still require some commodity anchor to link money to labor? I think that that was, in one sense, the function historically of gold, is that gold was a produced commodity, so Marx could make a certain argument that at the root of all the various forms money assumes, there is this convertibility into gold, and gold is actual repository of objectified labor. Therefore, you can reconstitute, and this happens particularly in moments of crisis, the link between money and labor through the general commodity. Well, so the question then becomes, if you don't have that, and I think no one would argue that we actually live in a gold convertible society, how do you actually reinstitute or reconstitute a commodity or quasi-commodity basis of money? So a lot of my interest in this actually grew out of trying to critique the work of Bryan and Rafferty on derivatives, who made an interesting but I think incorrect argument that derivatives actually represent a new form of commodity money. To make a long story short, I would argue that it's the actual payment of the wage, the money wage, that actually is the empirical nexus that links money to a quantity of expected labor. Now, there's a lot of questions about how then you measure labor, but I think in an empirical sense that the money wage, when a capitalist advances a money wage, they're essentially making an advance against an expected quantity of future money, essentially, is what they're doing. And I think that the money wage allows us to reconstitute the link between the advance of a quantity of money and a quantum of labor. Now, how that labor actually gets produced and mapped and represented in the process of circulation is complex. But this little diagram up here, it's not a model, but it's just meant to try and kind of illustrate how I see this process actually taking place. So there's an advance of money wage. The second ratio is a quantum of expected future labor. So really it's kind of a functional relation. It's not a causal relation. Last one is a measure of money over the money advance for labor power. So V is basically variable capital, L is expected labor, and M is the amount of money. And I think that we can think of this as that there's a monetary productivity of labor, right? So that when capitalists advance money, there's a certain expected rate of return on social labor. That's what we might call the rate of surplus value or the rate of exploitation. This, of course, is the big mystery, is how does this take place? What are all the mediations that exist between the advance of money and the actual realization or the objectification of the labor so advanced? This is another way of sort of getting into this question of how does labor value, how does abstract labor actually enter into the determination of the monetary representation of that labor in circulation? That to me, I remain frankly somewhat puzzled by this in terms of, again, if we reject the idea that there's just a that L is just this quantum, and it's kind of this fixed quantum, and then it's mapped through the system of prices into this M, and that somehow there's a binding or determining constraint, right? That through that binding constraint, we would say that L determines M. So this is all rather, I'm going to skip this. The question that I think theoretically that I'm interested in is, how do we think about this ratio? So I think that if the falling rate of profit in Marxist theory, I think the fundamental ratio is what's called the output to capital ratio, and it's basically this. So this is kind of hard to see, but this Q over K, that's a material rate. This Q is just the amount of stuff that's kind of produced. This K is all the gunk that's used to produce it, just a material measure. And what we have in empirical sense in this relationship is that we have prices of output and we have the prices of capital. And that's kind of, I think, the simplest way to represent this idea of an output to capital ratio. And I think that the key Marxian claim is that this one, labor expended at time t over the value of capital at time t, so there's a certain amount of labor set in motion over this mass of capital, and as that ratio falls, it should induce a effect at the level of prices in terms of a falling rate of profit. So this is all kind of setting up, you know, the problem as I see it. So I don't know if I'm going to be able to get around very much to the answer, but this is a different way of representing the same problem, is that it's a temporal problem. One thing that I would say is that I don't think we can approach this issue within simultaneous models. It's a time-dependent process. I think it's absolutely essential that we think about how this operates in a logical, it's a successive process. So this, if this is falling, it's only mapped or its effects are not felt immediately. They would be felt at some later point in time. So we have a temporal dynamic. This is my current thinking about this. If I'm wrong, I'm not wedded to this. If there's a different way of understanding this, I'd be very interested in hearing it. But I have never been able to see how at the level of the specification of abstract aggregate variables, you can actually show the mediations of the mechanisms through which the falling rate of profit would operate. And so I think what we need to do to begin to approach this problem is move more to the level of the competition between capitals. I just don't think you can derive relations of determination or causality without imposing certain constraints. So for instance, the temporal single system interpretation, which has actually influenced my thinking about this a lot, will derive the falling rate of profit from this, a decline in this ratio over time. But they do it, they have to impose a constraint. And what is the constraint? They hold the monetary equivalent of labor time constant. So they essentially impose a constraint that guarantees the result. They don't really explain, I think they're on the right track, but they don't actually explain how this mechanism works, because we know that the amount of labor represented by a unit of money over time falls. I think we know that, right? Labor becomes more productive, prices go up. Therefore, less labor is being represented by a unit of money or quantum of money. So you can't hold it constant to derive, quote, the law. It's sort of tautological. You basically guaranteed your result. So the how much time do I have? 3 minutes. The paper I sent to Anwar, which was not entirely coherently thought out, but I think that, you know, the direction that my thinking about this is gone is in distinguishing between what I would call an innovating and a regulating capital. So the innovating capitals are capitals that adopt new technologies that reduce costs. And we can think of a regulating capital as kind of the social average capital. It's a capital that has the average cost structure, produces at the average cost within a sector. And if you value the fixed capital, if you take all the investments that have been invested in a sector for the average capitals for the sector as a whole, and then you introduce not a technological change, and this is the other thing that in a lot of economic models, Schroffian models, simultaneous models, you introduce technological change and everything just changes. It's like there's no history. It's like, oh, everyone just adopts a new technique, everyone's more productive and the profit rate goes up, therefore Marx is wrong. That's not true. That's not how the world, if you make that assumption, you can show that the profit rate should just be going up indefinitely. It should never fall. It's another perverse result that you get by imposing constraints that guarantee the conclusion that you want to come to. In reality, firms enter, or a sector enters, a production period with an enormous amount of sunk costs. Many of those represent investments from 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and it's not hard to show, although the mathematics gets complicated, but it's not hard to show that if you introduce a more effective technique, that initially if prices are constant, the rate of profit in the sector as a whole will go up. But that as the price falls, the rate of profit on the social average capitals will tend to fall. And
okay, I don't have, I should probably not even show this, it's kind of an ugly diagram, but
but it's basically like you can show, like I was trying to figure out how to show this, because you get into some certain complexities, you get into
I don't know how to get back
the you issues around inflation, disinflation, etc. But the basic logic, and I think the way we can begin to move forward around this is to again think about sectors and think about different capitals and how sectors and capitals enter into periods with historic costs, and those are not immediately transformed or revised when new techniques are introduced. So I could try, these are just examples that show the operation of the basic tendency and then counter tendencies. And it's not hard to just, you know, construct simple numerical examples where you just make certain assumptions, and that you, and the key column here is this. So I'll just conclude with this. When you, and this, the period two is the innovating capital, and then the rest are the total capitals. And you can see that if you just allow the price to fall, that initially the rate of profit goes up for the innovating capital, but it goes down for the sector as a whole. Then if real, here I drop real wages, so I basically to where they were, so that the effect that we're seeing by this point is not due to an increase in real wages. So I'm holding real wages constant. It's still lower, but then by here, what I'm doing is I'm allowing the cheapening of constant capital. So the profit rate begins to go up. This result here, where it goes way up, this is basically what you get in a simultaneous system. This is if you take the new technique, assume it's fully adopted all at once by all firms in the sector, the rate of profit goes up. So this is basically the Okisha theorem. It's a simple demonstration, and I think this is wrong, because obviously the rate of profit in capitalist history is not always going up. So the Okisha theorem and the whole critique of Marx based on that, in my opinion, is incorrect. I will just conclude by saying, having gone through all this, it's still not clear to me how value actually enters into a determinant into our explanation of the falling rate of profit, because you can get these results without actually referring directly to labor values. So I end with the same question I began.
Our third speaker is Michael Roberts. Where is it going?
Right, well, 15 minutes. As Pete Green said, Michael Roberts has always got a graph for every occasion. Well, I've only got 45 graphs today, so you'll keep blinking and you may catch one or two of them. But before I start, make sure you've read this carefully. This is the health warning. You've got that in? But basically what you're going to hear now could well be dismissed with a pinch of salt. So, profit nexus. The premise of the paper is that investment is the key driver of economic growth. Not consumption, not other possibilities of animal spirits, but investment is the key to growth and the main swing factor in cycle of boom and slump. So I'm presenting to you an argument that the Keynesian macro identity suggests that investment drives GDP, employment, profits, and therefore growth through the mechanism of the effective demand, while we can look at Marxist theory and say that it's actually profit that calls the tune, not investment. Profit is part of surplus value or the unpaid labour in production, and it's the result of the exploitation of labour. Keynesian macro identities are thus back to front. Investment does not cause profit, profit causes investment. This is a big distinction, in my view, between the two schema for looking at capitalist economy. And I'm going to argue that there's plenty of evidence to show that the latter Marxist approach is right. Profits drive and lead investment in the business cycle, and there's very little evidence that investment drives profits as the Keynesian model would suggest. And there's a policy conclusion from that, because government spending or budget deficits, net borrowing, will not restore or sustain economic growth or end slumps. These only end when the profitability of business capital is revived. Therefore, the Keynesian multiplier is less compelling than the Marxist multiplier. Now, here's a graph which looks at previous recessions in the post-war period for the US. And what do we notice? If we look from the peak just before the slump to the trough of the slump, we can see that personal consumption doesn't really move that much. It's pretty stable. And in some of these slumps, it's actually up over that period from the peak to the trough of the slump. And yet, if we look at the green bar, we can see that investment, which in this case, also, in most cases, I can break it down, but not today, includes not just business investment, but also investment in housing, residential investment, real estate investment. But it's hugely down before the slump takes place, and the swing, therefore, it's the biggest swing factor, much bigger than consumption is. In fact, the reduction in consumption is way less than a fall in GDP over that period, which obviously is actually a logical result of the fact that investment is the main investment swing factor. So I want to quickly look at the macro identities, which are provided in all our Keynesian textbooks. National income equals national expenditure. So national income be made up of profits and wages. That equals national expenditure made up of investment and consumption. If we then we can break that further down, so profits plus wages equals investment plus consumption. Now, if we assume that all wages are spent on consumption and not saved, not an entirely realistic picture, but not so far out, then we find that profits will equal investment. That's the simple macro identity at the end of the process. Now, which way around is it? Back to front. Profits depend on investment is the Keynesian one on this identity. The Marxist one is investment depends on profit. And as far as Marx is concerned, profit depends on the exploitation of labour power and its appropriation by capital. So there's an objective causal analysis based on a particular form of class society under Marx, while for Keynes, the reason for investment driving profits is arranged to all kinds of individual behaviour, often called animal spirits, etc. And now here is a one-minute analysis of the law of tenets of the rate of profit of fall. Are you ready? S over C plus V. And here's the trick. If you divide variable capital through that process, you can see that the rate of profit will rise if the rate of surplus value rises more than the organic composition of capital. That is, S over V rises faster than C over V, or vice versa. So ROP falls if C over V rises faster than S over V. CV rises faster. That's Marx's view. That's the tendency that applies across the board in a capitalist economy over a long period of time. I think it's now 150 years, probably longer, but certainly in turn put down as an analysis. In September, it'll be 150 years since it was first published. But there are all times when S over V rises faster than that, and that's a counter tendency. But on the whole, we will get a result where the rate of profit will start to fall, and falling, that the only way that process will be avoided, the recession will come to an end in the course of the slump, is for the bottom, the denominator parts, to be devalued. Falling C, businesses closed, bust, mergers centralized, wages down, reserve army rises, we get S over C plus V rises. Therefore, the rate of profit rises, and the massive profit rises. The cycle of profit resumes. Here is a graph of my brilliant analysis of the cycle of profit, starting with accumulation growth, then we have a fall in the rate of profit, the orange side on the right-hand side, eventually leading to a fall in the massive profit, then a collapse in investment, and a realization crisis. Yes, there is a realization crisis, but it comes through the process of the rate of profit and the massive profit falling. This triggers a financial collapse. Yes, various triggers could be stock market, banks, housing bubbles. We've seen them over the last 50, 100 years. Eventually, that creates a devaluation of capital, massive profits rise, labor costs reduced, investment stopped as a result, and we get the rate of profit up and we start the whole process again. Some of that rate of profit increase, and that profit will be both tangible and fictitious, which will have the time. Here we have the evidence that the rate of profit has been falling. Carl was talking about it earlier, and here's one measure from yet another Marxist economist, in this case, actually Anwar's. Measure the rate of profit, which he shows in the case of the US, and I took this from his analysis from his book. He provides excellent data available to you online to manipulate all his figures as you feel fit. And you can see that the official figures show a slightly different result from Shaikh's, which you can read in his book, Capitalism, to explain why. And I think he's right about making those modifications. But you can see, as Carl said, that it flatlines, more or less, from 1980s onwards in the case of the US. Peter Jones in Australia said, well, we can actually, if we strip out some of the fictitious nature of the rate of profits that are involved in measuring profit, we can get an even sharper fall over the period, certainly from the 1960s. No time to explain what he means by fictitious at the moment. Here's a figure produced by me looking at the G7, and you can see on the basis of a current cost measure, because that's what I could do on the G7 at the moment, you can see the same decline in the G7 rate of profit, a simple mean, to the early 80s, then the recovery, quite a significant recovery, and then interestingly, from about the early 2000s, a significant fall in the G7's rate of profit before the Great Recession. That always rings a bell for me. The Great Recession may well have something to do with the sharp fall in the rate of profit. Terrible thing to say. Then we can see that if we look here, we can see the, as already Cedric has pointed out, the continual fall in the investment to GDP ratio in the G7 economies throughout the period since the 1980s. I'm only saying it that far back. And in this period, we see significant changes in the rate of profit for the G7 on my measure. And I've circled a bit which I would argue is the anomaly that everybody's been talking about, both in Cedric's paper and elsewhere, and perhaps there's something we can explain there. But what we do notice is that the rate of profit comes down sharply, and that falls back into line with the rate of investment to GDP ratio slowing in over that period of time. These are mainstream economists' estimates of looking at the rate of profit, which is NI, the dotted line here, and CAPEX. Is that fine? It's gone or left?
Left.
Oh, no problem. There's only another 50 graphs to go. We can see a strong correlation here on this graph. I hope you're blinking now. Get blinking. Profits leading investment 1 year ahead. Investment in the US follows US corporate profits down. Now, this is the bit that you will have to blink fairly carefully at. The Kolesky equation is profits equals investment less non-capitalist savings. That's households, government and foreign savings. If corporate savings or profits is in trouble, then maybe if we reduce the others, we can get savings. The savings is made up of that whole process. If households and corporations save more, as they tend to do in a slump, and foreign savings rise, then domestic investment will be lowered and so will profits. So the Kolesky argument goes. Too much savings means slump in the Kolesky calculation. The Marxist equation is that profits plus non-capitalist savings will lead to investment, but if business profits are static, then investment will fall unless households, corporations or foreign savings rise, not fall. And more importantly, contrary to the Keynesian position, far from government spending or government dis-saving helping, it's a negative for business profits, and if business profits lead investment, then it's a negative for business investment. That doesn't mean to say, of course, that government investment couldn't compensate, but that's another issue we have to discuss. Is this right empirically? Krugman says that deficit financing has been the fiscal austerity, in this case of his multiplier here, has produced a negative effect on growth. The correlations between GIPs, that's Greece, Italy, Portugal and Spain, the disaster economies of the last recession, yes, there's a slight negative factor between if they carried fiscal austerity out, there was a fall in growth. But if you look at the G6 economies, the other ones apart from Italy, actually, They implied fiscal austerity, and there has been growth over the period of 2010-2015. So there's a contradiction there, it seems to me. If I look at profitability, or the change in net return on capital along the horizontal line here against the change in real GDP over the same period, the correlations are strongly positive. So the more profit you get, the more growth you get. Big surprise, but apparently it's something which is disputed by the mainstream economists. So profitability is a much higher correlation and connection to the change in profit than changes in government spending, negative or otherwise. I looked at all these different sectors, looked at these five decades or so in the US, and I found that the average real GDP growth rate as a ratio of the average change in real government expenditure, or as a ratio of the change in net return on capital, could be compared, and the rate of profit ratio with growth is way higher on nearly every occasion except 1990 to 00, and on some occasions it's incredibly low for government spending. So there is the net return on capital correlation is hugely more positive. The net return, the position between government expenditure and growth, there's hardly any correlation at all. A case study of Japan, so something similar. Huge budget deficits in Japan over the last 10 years or so, still the case, yet their growth has been lower on GDP basis compared to the euro area or the US, where their budget deficits have been much smaller. So the conclusion I'm putting to you is that the Keynesian view that effective demand and investment drives profits is really logically weak and empirically unproven. The Marxist view that profitability and profit drive investment in a capitalist economy is theoretically sound and empirically supported, and that the Marxist multiplier, which I define as changes in real GDP relative to profitability, is a better guide to any sustained change in a capitalist economy than the Keynesian multiplier, changes in real GDP relative to government net spending. So therefore, Keynesian fiscal stimulus policy prescriptions, which pervade the labour movement at the moment, with Monsieur Mélenchon, amongst others, presenting it to us only today, are unlikely to restore investment growth and employment in a capitalist economy. Indeed, they could even delay recovery.
I can do it from here, I gather, because there's no room up there. Can you see me? Can you hear me, Pierre? Should I go up there?
I'm going to come up and do Anwar. I shout more than you, you see.
Empty your seat here if someone wants it.
Well, thank you. I want to thank, first of all, the participants for these very interesting papers and also for their discipline. If the left had this discipline, we would be in power. So keep that in mind.
It's never going to happen, then.
No, it's never going to happen, right? And I was trying to think about what to say about agreement before I talk about disagreement. And there's very little agreement about things except that Marx is a good reference, that capitalism is a system which has some intrinsic properties, many of them powerful and some bad. And I think that one can read between the lines of everybody there about the agreement that orthodox economics is perhaps not the ideal way to study economics. It has many deficiencies. But after that, the disagreements are pretty much everything else. And I want to just highlight some of them and also suggest some ways to narrow them. One of the fault lines always in any discussion of Marx is the question of competition versus monopoly. And we see that here. It comes up, especially with financialization. It comes up with large-scale production. And I want to just note that this fault line goes all the way back to Engels' students, Kautsky and Bernstein. Then it becomes picked up by Hilferding, and that would not have mattered had it not been picked up by Lenin. And once it got picked up by Lenin, it became the dominant point of view in the Marxist tradition. Yet often you see in today's discussion the emphasis on competition. And one of the arguments I've made my whole life is that that diversion into competition from competition monopoly was a huge mistake. It was a mistake because Marxism was captured by orthodox economics. By captured, I mean that the notion of competition in Marx was replaced by the notion of competition in Friedman, and those are exactly, by the way, the terms of the Monthly Review School recently, that Friedman was the right representation of competition, and of course you look around the world, that's not what you see, and then it follows that because you don't see it, it must be something wrong that capitalism has transformed, and perfect competition in bourgeois economics is all firms are impotent, tiny, passive servants of the consumer, and since that's never been true, it follows that we now have something different. But since it's never been true, it couldn't have been true in Marx's time either, and one should stop and think when he's talking about competition, is he really talking about that? The book I'm going to be talking about later in the plenary section is devoted, in fact, to my 20 years of writing and 40 years of thinking about these issues and trying to put together an argument that competition is in fact now and has always been the dominant force in capitalism, and some implications will follow. So I'm going to draw on some of that in these discussions, but one has to say that part of the difficulty that you see in these three papers, or the themes that you see repeated, is the difficulty of moving from the abstract to the concrete. And that difficulty is not resolved by understanding methodology. You could not, if you had read Hegel, be Newton. I guarantee you that. You could not have figured out the science that Newton figured out, or Einstein, just by having read books on philosophy. Because the science itself is a movement from the abstract to the concrete, and the method is embedded in that particular movement. And that is a problem for us, if we're referring to Marx, because Marx did not finish his work. He worked 40 years on what has been called his beloved economics, and he wrote one book out of the four that was supposed to be, one volume out of the four that's supposed to be book one. Book one was the most abstract. Everything was deliberately simplified and made abstract. And book one is volumes 1, 2, 3, and Surplus Value, of which he only wrote volume one. The other books, five books, that was supposed to move all the way from this level of abstraction to the world economy and crises and all of that, we don't even know what he had to say in most of that because it hasn't been translated, hasn't been put together. And so we face a difficulty that we're taking a book that was abstract and then we're confused and conflicted about how to move to the concrete. I always use the following analogy. When Newton was working on his famous work, Explanation of the Laws of Gravity, he had realized early on that objects, two masses are attracted to each other. That's a famous example, the apples, the stem weakens and the apple falls to the ground. And Newton understood actually that the ground moves to meet the apple because there's a movement of both masses. Only the movement on the ground is small compared to the movement of the apple because of their relative masses. But then he had a problem. He could look up and he could see a large mass hanging there, which was the moon, and it was not hurtling down to the earth. So Newton stopped his publication, Ridley stopped, until he could figure out how to reconcile what was an apparent, blatant contradiction between his law of gravity, which he could prove on earth, and the fact that the moon was not falling into the earth. And it led him ultimately to the discovery, to the understanding that when you become more concrete, in his case, you consider masses in relation to each other, then one of the possible outcomes is the masses will orbit. And with that, he had solved a problem that humanity had never even posed properly and solved it. But what if he died before that? What if he died in volume one of Newton? Then Marxism, then Newtonism would split into a variety of schools of thought, each insisting on a different foundation, a different part of the argument, a different equation, and a different interpretation, and every new phenomena would be seen as a new state of nature. And that, I believe, is exactly what happened to Marxism. Each new phenomena, because it was not addressed adequately in the first place, appears as if it's a new stage of capitalism. And let's say, face it, academics have this possibility of being discoverers, explorers of new capitalism by announcing that it's new. but we should also have some humility and think that perhaps it's not new, it's perhaps a defect in our knowledge that we are announcing when we discover a new stage of something. So I'm a deep conservative in this sense. I really think that you have to pay attention to the logic of an argument and try to build it up step by step and recognize where the gaps are and then say, look, I don't know. And before you announce that our lack of knowledge is a new stage, you might consider that it's the oldest stage of all, which is a lack of understanding. So let me try to illustrate what I mean by that. It's a problem we all face. Anyone coming from Marx faces this problem, that we have to take this story seriously. So I'm going to make my comments in reverse order I'm going to move from the abstract to the concrete because many of the illustrations already, to the concrete to the abstract. So starting with Michael's argument, I completely agree, and he demonstrates, I think, very forcefully that investment is the key driver of economic growth at a concrete level. And it's a very nice idea of Marxist multiplier versus a Keynesian multiplier. The profit drives growth on effective demand. Profit drives and leads investment. But let me note, again, the theoretical issue involved here. Marx actually argues that it's expected profit that drives investment. Of course, that's obvious. When you build a plant, it's not the profit that you're getting on your existing plant, it's the extrapolation that you make into the future. Mm-hmm. So expected profit drives accumulation. Moreover, expected profit drives production. Every day when you open the plant, you have to make a judgment. Do I want to continue? Are people going to buy the product or not? And that's a judgment about short-run expected profitability. So the key thing that drives capitalism is expectations of profitability. Now, if we left it at that, we would be Keynes, because Keynes says the same thing, and I'm going to talk about this tonight. But what Marx says is, but the expectation of profitability has to relate itself to the actuality of profitability. And so he goes a step back and says, let me discuss the actuality of profitability. And that's a discussion of, first of all, value, before surplus value, then surplus value, then profit. And I'm going to come back to this issue of profit and surplus value in a minute, but just to remind you that this is methodologically appropriate. When you start at the most abstract level and you build in the concrete elements that appear to contradict your own argument by showing that when you introduce them, you can produce a phenomenon. In Newton, for instance, we all know this. You take a column, you drop two balls in that column, which has got a vacuum, suck the air out, drop them, they'll fall to the ground the same way, even if one is a golf ball and the other is a ping pong ball. But now you introduce some air, and of course a ping pong ball will fall more slowly than the golf ball because air is a fluid and they're falling in the fluid. Everybody learns this in physics. But we don't remember the methodological implication of that is that Newton's law of gravity is true under certain conditions, and then its manifestation depends on the more concrete factors. Are these things moving around each other? You might get orbits. Is there a fluid? They might move differently. These are not contradictions. These are the great virtue of the science, that you can explain all of them from the same principle in concrete expression. So when we come to this idea of profit, expected profitability, we have two expectations to deal with. One is long-term, that's how you make investment. And the other is short-term, you keep your business going day-to-day, month-to-month. And I'm going to argue tonight a little bit more about the implication of that for the theory of effective demand in Keynes and so on. But this leads to exactly the problem that Michael is talking about, which is the difference between expected and realized profits. Mm-hmm. Post-Keynesians, Keynes, by the way, doesn't make this mistake. Keynes is very clear, profitability is driven by expectation of production. And he says, I quote in my book, for instance, that Keynes says, the engine which drives capitalism is profit, that drives production or business is profit. So he's very clear about that. And he says expectation of profit. So when you look at realized profit, you have this difficulty. How do you distinguish between a realized profit driving capital and realized profit being the result of investment? And the answer is by looking at lags. That's one way of looking at it. But there's a simpler, obvious answer. Pick up any textbook in business and they will tell you the answer. They invest their money with the expectation of making profit. And hence there is already a methodological distinction between what drives investment and drives production and what investment and production creates, which is realized profits and realized surplus value. The difference then is to explain how expectations are driven by realization. And Marx doesn't talk about this, and we should be clear, and neither does Keynes. One place where I found useful to talk about, look at this, is Soros, who knows a little bit about expectations, profits, and finance, and he makes the argument that expectations are regulated by the fundamentals. And I'm going to come back tonight, so I won't. One point which I had just a comment on in Michael's presentation was the adjustment of the profit rate data for, I don't know the author's name, the man who takes out the fictitious capital.
P.D. Jones.
Okay, I don't know that work, but I have to say that just to let people know, if you're going to do work at a concrete level, you really have to know how the data is constructed, because it's constructed on the base of a theory, and it's not your theory. So therefore, you need to know how your theory relates to the facts, and if you can map them back into what you need. Capital gains are excluded in national income accounts from profit. So fictitious capitals profits are excluded. That raises an interesting question where they come from, and I will address that a little bit tonight. But for now, the main thing is that interest payments, which are also payments to finance capital, are a legitimate part of profit and surplus value because they're sharing out of it. So you can't take out interest payments. The only thing you can take out is what I spent some time on the book is what's imputed interest payments, which are not interest payments that businesses pay, but interest payments which are added in order to make the treatment of finance capital similar to the treatment of manufacturing. And that's literally, they understand that. They call it imputed interest payment, but the treatment of it is very arcane. It's really mind-boggling. But you can find it hidden in there, and you can take it out. And the numbers that Michael showed for me is, in fact, after you take out the numbers they add in, which they concede are completely fictitious. But they needed to balance the theory, the empirical evidence, with their theory. Let me then move to Carl, which is the idea, which is discussion of the rate of profit in intertemporal circuit of capital. Now, again here, one key link is that the rate of profit drives investment, but it's the expected rate of profit, so how do expectations link to the actual rate of profit? And then the question that arises for Marx is how does the actual rate of profit get related to the actual mass of profit and to surplus value? And that's clearly the break that Marx makes by showing that surplus value is the foundation of profit in industrial capital. Now, what concerns Karl is that that set of statements, and certainly in Marx, is very abstract, and that different people have taken it forward in different ways, and they have different representations of it, and particularly the transformation problem in the Marxist literature, and the profits are not equal to surplus value. Does that mean that surplus value is wrong, that value is wrong? Many Marxists have gone all the way back. So let me just say a word in defense of Marx. Marx does not argue that profits are equal to surplus value. He argues that in industrial capitalism, if you exclude what he calls unequal exchange, which is the volume one of capital, then under the conditions that he set up, which is these abstract conditions of the vacuum without the other elements, then profit will be equal to surplus value. But he doesn't say that as a description of capitalism. And the statement of that is actually in Theories of Surplus Value, Volume 1, Chapter 1, he discusses Stuart's idea that there are two sources of profits, profit on unequal exchange and profit on production, and Marx says, right on, that's absolutely correct. And I, Carl, will do it later when I get there. Of course, he doesn't get there. And people don't notice that this is a necessary part of the theoretical project then. How do you explain merchant capital's profits long before industrial capital was invented? And that goes back in every society. Industrial capital comes out of Europe, but merchant capital is all societies across the whole world. Africa, Asia, Middle East, Latin America, everywhere, merchant capital existed, and merchant trading existed, and profits existed. So we need to have that theoretically understood. So then this problem of the lack of connection between profit and surplus value leaves many people, including Carl, to move backwards to the point where there is some grounding, so to speak, and in his case he settles on the link between the wage and the expected employment of labor. I would argue that if you're going to do it that way, it should at least be between the price and the expected amount of value in the good, or the expected amount of product in the good, however you want to do it. Now just note that Marx's own starting point is actually from something he calls simple commodity production. And people, again, don't notice this because it's kind of obscure. Rome paid for itself at its value, then there would be no profit. And what he's really talking about is what was well known in the economics literature, that if you buy something cheap and sell the same thing again for a higher price, you can make a profit. And that's called buying cheap and selling dear. And he explicitly excludes that. So paying attention to that, I think, helps deepen the understanding of what he's trying to do. I would argue that the connection should be simple commodity production, labor value, and money price. And then the role of money and how it comes about is different. The trouble with looking at the wage and the value of labor power is it leaves out the relation between profit and surplus value, or profit and transfer of value, and that is also very important. I agree with Karl that I think the key point that he makes is that competition is indeed the regulating mechanism of capitalism. But then a problem arises. Again, it's a problem of concretion. If you are abstracting from the differences among capitals within an industry, then the equalization of profit rates operates on the average capital because all capitals are alike. You've abstracted from that difference. So what does that mean? Profit rates are higher here than here. Capital flows to the higher profit rate and it pumps up the number of firms there and the number of supply. That brings the price down. Profit rates come down. The opposite where it leaves, profit rates are equalized. That's a level of abstraction. But then Marx argues himself that capital creates new technology. It's forced to by competition. Therefore, you're not going to find the capitals all alike because the theory itself derives the differences among the capitals. And then that raises the question of what you mean by a regulating capital, Marx's term, by the way. At a more concrete level, it's the capital which is the object of adulation by new investment. It's the capitals who have the best available technology. And this shows up in the treatment of rent, which even Marx calls horribly disgusting, difficult stuff in volume 3 of Capital when he's writing to Engels. I think he says this shit about rent is really maddening. But that is the difference between average and regulating capital. And that is, again, not the same thing. The two are not the same. So at a more concrete level, this derives a whole host of phenomena, which are exactly what we see. And yet now they're derived theoretically rather than being a contradiction to the theory. And that's a key point I try to make here. I think also there's a similar issue that Karl brings up, which is the idea that the new technique raises the rate of profit, the Ukiyo theorem and so on. I've argued against this since 1958. I'm impressed by how powerful my argument has been since nobody knows anything about it. But let me say it again. The notion of competition in Marx is different than Okisho's notion of competition. Okisho's is perfect competition. Marx's notion of competition is a war. And in a war, both sides can lose, but the losing side loses more. That's the whole point of a war. When Trump is threatening North Korea with nuclear war, he's making a bet, if he's that clever, that he's going to persuade them that they're going to lose more than we're going to lose. He may be wrong about that, but anyway, that's the bet. It's not saying that everybody will win. And in perfect competition, some firms win. They get higher profit rates with the new technology. So this is a small point, but it opens up a series of patterns and phenomena that are exactly what you see in the real process. So the last one, Cedric. Cedric makes a point, I think very important point, that there is a problem in the observed patterns of capitalism, that in the 1980s onward, profits were high, and yet investment in non-financial capital is not commensurately high. So what is the difficulty? He raises different explanations, the revenge of the rentiers, financial turn, higher rate of profit in finances raises the hurdle rate, and globalization. Now again here, for me, this is a methodological issue. In being concrete. At an abstract level, there's only one type of capital. So if profits are high, the capital comes back there. But at a concrete level, capital does not come back to itself. It goes where it finds the highest rate of return. And we know this. If you make your money selling hamburgers in California or in the Midwest, and then you can put them into finance in China, well, why not? That's what you do. The purpose of capital is to make money, not to make products, and not anything particular. There's no loyalty, no nationality, no product loyalty. So our problem then becomes, where do these profits go? And we can track them. It's not that hard to find out. They go into speculation, they go into real estate, they go to China, they go to Indonesia, they go to Mexico, where production is cheaper, because that is the way that they get better returns, or they protect themselves against other capitals. So I've always argued that if you look at it that way, then it's not hard to understand why investment in the center goes down. Hmm. Why is that a problem? The center happens to be making a lot of money. They're putting it into other parts of the world, or into finance, in buying hotels and houses in Brazil, in Rio, in Newfoundland. I mean, everywhere capital has flowed where the profit rate of return is higher. Now, it doesn't follow from this that the rate of return remains higher. And this is a very important point. Again, it's a matter of being concrete. How do you measure the rate of return, say, in the stock market? Well, you can't measure it as the average profit rate, because the stock market doesn't have any older capitals. So what you do in the stock market is take the capital goods appreciation, the rate of change of stock prices, and you add dividends, and that's the rate of return. That's what businesses do, and that's the appropriate rate of return. But the parallel rate of return in the real sector is not the average rate of profit. It's in fact the rate of profit on new investment. This is a theme always in Marx. You become more concrete. It's the new investment that counts, not the average. Why should you put your money in old plant and equipment? You don't, in fact. You treat them depreciation on the basis of some accounting rules. And that's basically because, as Cedric, I think, pointed out, they are no longer, Carl pointed out, I think, that they're no longer produced, so that there's no reproduction cost to them. So you just get your money back. The stuff you put in there, you depreciate over time. And these are perfect rules, perfectly sensible rules. But the rate of return on new capital then turns out to look just like the rate of return on financial capital. This is one of the things I do in my book. I plot the two together. They move together up and down. They have the same average, the same volatility, but there are periods of bubbles. You can see that. And also periods of whatever the opposite of bubbles is, deflations, where the stock market rate return is less than the real rate. So this then allows us to see that competition operates between the real sector and the financial sector. But if you don't make that concrete move from the rate of return in the financial sector to the incremental rate of return in the real sector, you have to conclude the financial sector is not related any longer to the real sector. And perhaps that's true, but perhaps it's a problem of not being sufficiently concrete and careful in the move itself. There are similar issues about intellectual property rights. I tend to oppose the idea that there's a new stage of monopoly capitalism, because I almost always see a signal as a new stage in our lack of knowledge. And so I like to ask, well, what's the question? This is your answer. What's the question? And the question with intellectual property is how we treat that. How do we treat the idea of intellectual property? How we treat idea of information? And I think that, again, is perfectly possible. Information is just a profit-making enterprise. They have rules. We need to understand their rules. We need to understand how profitability has an impact on them. But let me just mention to you, point out with you, that it's not true that large scale implies monopoly profits. This is the trope of orthodox Marxism, and it's just not true empirically. Data is very clear that larger capitals, and I present this large sample of data in my book, have lower profit rates than higher capital. They have bigger profits because they're big, but their rate of return is smaller. But the reason that is good for them is that their death rate is also smaller. So when you adjust for survival rates, against small and large capitals, you find they're remarkably similar. This is proof of real competition. So I argue you need to have a better understanding of the project and its applications before we start saying it doesn't work anymore. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org. a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.